Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was certainly an appropriately gloomy introduction in terms of basic tone. I want to begin by protesting on behalf of the members of the panel our scheduling on it. Not only is this the second consecutive year that I've had to appear at what has historically been known as a red-eye panel in Philadelphia Society Annals, and by the way, as I look around at some of my friends in the audience, it's obvious the traditions are being maintained here. But also, we've been asked to follow what has to go down as one of the greatest song and dance acts in the history of the Philadelphia Society, like last night's after-dinner talk. So there's no place to go but downhill after that, and we'll have to do our best down there in the depths, which is certainly where one has to go to talk about Henry Kissinger's philosophy of foreign affairs, which is my topic here this morning. I was hoping that Professor Nutter would be present, since I'm talking about matters that he has addressed in his recent book, published by AEI, called Kissinger's Grand Design, and since I differ with him in a couple of important particulars, it would have been useful to have an exchange. My central theme is a simple enough one. It is that there is to be found in the academic writings of Henry Kissinger a grand design for a reordered world, a grand vision of a stable world order, resting on, first, the acceptance of a modified international status quo by the superpowers, and buttressed by a military and political stalemate imposed by the presence in the world of nuclear weapons. And that new international order, in Kissinger's view, is to be called into existence by a series of bold and creative acts by a great statesman, the identity, of course, of whom is perfectly obvious. Let me repeat, that grand design is set forth in full in Kissinger's academic writings, and he has pursued it with a single-minded determination since he became our leading diplomatist and statecraft practitioner since 1969, ignoring facts which call into question its assumptions and ignoring as well the many obstacles which have arisen in the way of its fulfillment during that past six-year period. Let me repeat now, I'm saying several things that perhaps have not been said quite this way before. That grand design is drawn directly from Kissinger's academic writings. There is no real gap between his thinking as an academician and his work as a practitioner of statecraft. The grand design, the objectives, the means for its attainment are largely identical in his writings and in his diplomatic practice. Insofar as changes have occurred at all, it was in his view of the, or has been in his view of the possibilities for détente with the USSR, and here the changeover from his early hardline views to his present position occurred long ago, long before he assumed his present position. Other changes are more apparent than real, or can be explained in terms of the polemics he has had to engage in an attempt to sell his policies to the public. Second, whatever we will say in a few moments about Kissinger's approach to détente, he is not the typical garden variety détentist. He is not now, does not now, nor has he ever believed that the path to peaceful relations with the USSR is simply another 15% cut in the defense budget in order to convince the Soviets that we are serious in our search for peace. But neither is Kissinger, in most senses of the word, a conservative, although to be sure there are some conservative elements in his thinking. So with that background, let me talk about what I consider to be the four principal elements in Kissinger's grand design and briefly indicate how he has attempted to apply them as Secretary of State and as National Security Advisor, and perhaps we can develop some of the implications in the question and answer period. First of all, Kissinger has had, from the very beginning of his academic career, a carefully defined concept of the purposes of foreign policy. In his earliest book, A World Restored, which analyzed the statecraft of Metternich and Castlereagh during the period following the Napoleonic Wars, Mr. Kissinger presented his most complete statement on the purposes of foreign policy. And Metternich, he there instructs us approvingly, was primarily motivated by a desire to achieve a stable international order, rather than by a conviction that a world without conflict, a world of perfect peace and harmony, was possible, or by a belief that foreign policy should be inspired by high moral or philosophical purposes. And Kissinger's acceptance of this particular definition of the purposes of foreign policy sets him immediately outside the mainstream of most American commentary on such questions. Historically in this country, those of a liberal or utopian political persuasion have believed that wise and skillful American diplomacy could help create a world of peace and harmony, while those on the other side of the political spectrum have tended to argue that among our most important foreign policy objectives must be the creation of an international environment in which Western values flourish. In any case, a stable international order, in Kissinger's view, is defined as one in which there is no large-scale war between or among the major powers. War among the major powers, in Kissinger's view, can be avoided if what he calls the structure of the system, the basic distribution of influence and power in the world, is accepted by all the major powers. Such an order he believes to be both legitimate, in his word, and just, for he defines the just political order as a political arrangement which is generally agreed upon or accepted. Justice for Kissinger is not conceived as necessarily encompassing norms or values held to be morally correct or universally valid. He is, in fact, an ethical relativist who very early in his academic career indicated his profound skepticism about the possibility of rendering morally certain judgments about the comparative worth of political regimes. And in this respect also, he stands outside the mainstream of most American political commentary, at least commentary prior to the present period. And herein, obviously, is an explanation for much of his discomfiture over the moral opposition to communism exhibited by, for example, Alexander Solzhenitsyn. In any case, there are, in Kissinger's view, two essential bases for the construction of a stable order, and I haven't got the time to develop these. First, there must be what he calls a general equilibrium or balance of power, defined rather traditionally. And second, there must be what he calls a particular equilibrium, by which he means an agreement among the major powers on the settlement, on procedures for settling the dominant conflicts of the present period, the important issues, the structure of international politics in a given historical epoch. And this particular equilibrium, as he calls it, is to be achieved through agreement and negotiation rather than force, and must ultimately be based on what he calls a legitimizing principle, such as that reached at Vienna, such as that which he thinks the two superpowers reached at the Moscow summits of 72 and 73 in their agreement on basic principles for avoiding nuclear war and the rest. And that basic overall view of the purposes of policy has clearly inspired Kissinger's efforts as America's principal foreign policy architect during the past 6 years. He has repeatedly stated that under his tutelage, we as a nation have redefined our purposes away from the messianic moralistic approach of our early period, away from the purely defensive mode of the early post-war period to the present when we are embarked upon a grand quest for a new structure of peace. Second, Soviet-American relations. Here we must ask whether, in his view, a stable international order of the type I described is possible under present circumstances, or whether the presence of the Soviet Union in the world as a potential revolutionary power will impede the construction of this order. Here his views did undergo some evolution. I haven't got time to trace it throughout his writings. Obviously, in nuclear weapons and foreign policy, his most widely read and best known book, he takes a very hard line, denying flatly that a final settlement between East and West is possible, and basing that judgment on an analysis of Soviet objectives and Soviet intentions. What is not generally recognized is that within a very short time, as early as 1961, Kissinger began to retreat from that hardline position. In fact, questions can be raised, and maybe in the Q&A I'll get a chance to do that, as to whether he ever really believed it. In any case, in Necessity for Choice, published in 61, he abandons the recurrent theme of nuclear weapons that a substantial increase, for example, in Western strength is a precondition to serious negotiations with the USSR. Moreover, he abandons the clearly articulated position of his first book on this topic, that an East-West settlement is impossible until the Soviet ideological outlook is transformed. And he develops a new approach with overtones of the stability arguments of a world restored. And then by the time you get to 65, in his book, A Troubled Partnership, He has shifted his views even more substantially. He argues in this book, which is mostly devoted to Europe, that Soviet foreign policy has already moderated significantly, and moreover that there exist powerful forces in the Kremlin seriously interested in an accommodation with the West. He says in 1965 that, in fact, Kremlin policy is delicately balanced between the forces pushing for accommodation and the forces seeking continued confrontation, and that wise Western policy can give what he calls a powerful spur, one of his favorite Western metaphors, powerful spur to peaceful trends. And he spells out something of a program for doing exactly that. Since, of course, assuming his active foreign policy role, these trends have deepened and in ways that are familiar to all of you. Third, his position on the impact of nuclear weapons on foreign policy. Here I'll be fairly brief. Like many Western analysts, Kissinger from the very beginning was stunned by the awesome power of nuclear weapons. So great is their potential for destruction, he believes that, and has believed since 55, that nations are unlikely in the extreme to employ them unless their own survival is directly at risk. And moreover, he argues, when both superpowers possess numbers of nuclear weapons sufficient to deter an attack on their homelands, there exists what he calls a nuclear stalemate, a standoff, with neither power able to enforce its will on the other. He articulates these ideas first in the mid-50s, and he has never significantly departed from them. The consequences of nuclear stalemate, in Kissinger's view, are profound. First of all, it means that under conditions of stalemate, nations are denied the possibility of achieving what has always been the ultimate objective of war, the physical conquest of their opponent. In this respect, he argues, the nature of international politics itself has been transformed, and the policy calculations of all states immeasurably affected. Secondly, because of their awesome power, he argues, nuclear weapons can only avert disaster. They can never be put to use to serve the traditional purpose of military power, namely the achievement of a state's political and territorial objectives. And thus, in his view, the very role of power in international politics has been transformed. Whatever their ideological preferences, nations, at least rational nations, have no alternative but to accept the existing international status quo, political as well as military. He therefore argues that the effect of nuclear weapons on foreign policy is to powerfully reinforce the prospects for the creation of a stable relationship between the superpowers and thus for a new international order. It is on this basis also, I'll just say briefly, that he develops his whole approach to military strategy, where he is a so-called finite deterrence thinker, to arms control, where he's no longer interested in, and he says it directly, in the size or even the quality, and he says even the quality of the American deterrent force vis-a-vis that of the Soviet Union. Once we have a basic minimum deterrent, minimum capable deterrent force, our second strike capability, these issues are no longer of significance. Hence, in SALT, he can ignore the numerical disparities, SALT 1, SALT 2. He's not worried about the backfire or the cruise missile. What matters to him in both cases are conclusion of agreements which can add to the momentum of detente. And finally, the last element is theory of statesmanship. Very important to an understanding of Kissinger's grand design. He has a reputation, of course, especially in the academy, of being a so-called political realist, stemming in part, it must be conceded, from his bleak appraisal of human nature, his rejection of the possibility of establishing a perfectly harmonious system. But there is, and there always has been, another side to the Kissinger outlook on international politics, less well known, but which sheds quite a different light on his position on the realist-idealist spectrum. And in talking about realism, he begins by pointing out, in A World Restored and elsewhere, that there are two kinds of realists, those who use facts and those who create them. And it is in the second category that he places himself, and I quote now, "The West requires nothing so much as men able to create their own reality." And of course, we know where we normally put people who try to create their own reality. "We today stand on a brink," he says, "tottering between unprecedented chaos and unparalleled creativity. Unfortunately, in his view, when talking about the statesman, every creative act is lonely because certain knowledge in the political realm is impossible to attain. The great statesman," he says, "must therefore inevitably act on the basis of an intuition that is inherently unprovable and reach decisions not on the basis of facts, but in terms of his vision of the future. In the process, he will be opposed by the bureaucracy, the legislature, even the public, but he must proceed in any case," Kissinger tells us. "Statesmen must have the courage of their convictions and act as if they are," I quote, "act as if their intuition were truth, attempting to educate their countrymen in the process. The great statesman, therefore, must be willing to run great risks of a creative nature and pursue his vision with boldness and daring. The attribute, he says, which has enabled the spirit to transcend an impasse at so many crises of history is the ability to contemplate an abyss, not with the detachment of a scientist, but as a challenge to be overcome or to perish in the process. I underline that. And tragic stature, he says, lies not in the bittersweet resignation of men like Metternich, who built his order upon an outmoded principle, but in contemplating chaos, adapting to new trends, and gambling that one can shape them rather than be overcome by them. Admittedly, therefore, international agreements are sometimes possible only by ignoring safeguards against capricious action, again his quote, and the result may be, quote, essentially arbitrary decisions, unquote, which are, quote, especially dangerous in a revolutionary period. And he concludes, the statesman is therefore like one of the heroes in a classical drama, or as he referred to himself in an unguarded moment in an interview with a female Italian journalist, the lone cowboy who follows his solitary vision in pursuit of greatness and is willing to contemplate chaos in the process. He may fail to achieve his vision, but greatness lies in the attempt and in the grandeur of the vision as much as in actual success. It is better to risk greatly and fail than to be content with mediocrity or what he calls stodgy prudence, to be, and I quote again, like the fallen angel who is beautiful without peace, great in his conceptions and exertions, but without success, proud and lonely. He quotes Bismarck approvingly in that connection. Well, I'll use up more than my time. Let me just conclude by saying that, in my view, his theory of statesmanship makes excellent script for a Greek tragedy, but is certainly ultimately incompatible with the pursuit of a consistently realistic foreign policy. Although he has on many occasions acknowledged that policymakers must be prepared for the worst contingency, clearly Kissinger's fundamental preference is for daring rather than caution. His most cherished goal is to partake in creation, a word which in fact appears frequently in his writings and speeches. Kissinger, in fact, is ultimately impatient with the intractable realities of the present, and far from being a realist or a conservative in any sense, there glimmers within him some of the utopian penchant for absolute sweeping solutions which concentrate instead of on realities upon a vision of the future. Although he has often criticized the American diplomatic tradition for exemplifying these very tendencies, Henry Kissinger is, in fact, far more American than he knows. Thank you.